Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign, and I'm here on May 22nd, 2024 at Jack Straw Studios, and I'm here with David Bloom. So David, thank you so much for making time to be here today. So we talked about it a little bit before this interview, but tell me a little bit of how you got into all of this work.
It's a long story. I have to go back. I'm a minister. So this goes back to my seminary training in the 60s.
And that was New Haven?
No.
Or no?
No, West Coast.
Okay.
I was in – I'm an American Baptist minister, and – I graduated from a seminary in our denomination in Southern California, L.A. area. Mm-hmm. I was there in the late 60s. And while I was there, we were right on, as the old song goes, L.A. is a great big freeway. And we were at the San Bernardino Freeway about 20 miles from downtown, but it was all just one big place. And fortunately, we were visited by some of the local activists who invited some of us into the activities in the city, which included – and this was like in 67, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 67, 68. The Watts riots had been 65. So the city was still on edge. And the local ecumenical group, Southern California Council of Churches, I think – had organized an ecumenical interracial group of pastors and lay people who were working together to try to heal the city, I guess. So I used as just a seminary student used to go to those meetings, and it just kind of grew from there. I saw that, and this was right near the end of Dr. King's life, and so his activism was just really blossoming at that point, and I was fascinated by it. And I said, it's where the church ought to be. It's where I ought to be. So it was a learning experience out of that. So I came out of seminary, and then, of course, King was assassinated in 68. And he was my model for ministry. There are some others as well, but he was one of the principal ones in terms of where the church ought to be in terms mm-hmm. of social issues, justice issues, et cetera. And so I went on from there, came out of seminary with a strong orientation to two things, Well, three things: ecumenical work, urban work, and social justice work. That's the frame in which I entered pastoral ministry, which I was only in for a little less than 8 years. First, and then I went from there all the way back to the East Coast to be on the staff of a church there. But right off the bat, got involved in ecumenical stuff. We organized a coffee house in Mystic, Connecticut, for kids who didn't have anything to do in this big tourist town and were just getting in trouble, and was very successful. Then I spent a year at Princeton Seminary with another degree, and then was in Washington, D.C. for 4 years on the staff of a big, like Plymouth downtown or First Baptist, one of those kinds of places, with a long activist history. Got involved in, again, what became known as the downtown cluster of congregations, trying to address issues on the street, hunger issues, and so on. So I always gravitated toward those kinds of ecumenical activities. And then a classmate from seminary was the pastor here at University Baptist Church, which no longer exists. And we had talked about the possibility of working together, and position opened. I moved out here in 75 and was on the staff. Two things happened there. Number one, I started to hear about the Church Council of Greater Seattle, which I said, whoa, what's this? And turns out it's one of the most active, comprehensive ecumenical agencies in the country at that time. It is no longer. It still exists, but it's taken on a different shape. And Bill Cate, who was the 20-year director of the Church Council, came and preached at University Baptist. And I said, oh, I like this guy, and I like what he's talking about. And at the this was in 76 maybe, and the issue of redlining was starting to come up in the mm-hmm. communities, and there was a secular organization called the SCOR, the Seattle Coalition on Redlining. Daryl Grothaus, who if you have not interviewed, I think you should. He was at the director at the time. He worked, I think, for the city's used to be called the Office of Policy Planning. And he was the staff to this I got ahead of myself. I think it started with the city agency. They had a redlining task force, with the city, probably under OPP. And Daryl, I think, was the staff. Simultaneously, there was a community group that organized called the Seattle Coalition on Redlining SCOR. And then also the Church Council organized a task force mm-hmm. on redlining. So there's this issue, and I was just right in it. And I started going to meetings, and people that at SCOR, Nick Licata, Frank Chopp, Alice Wolt, mm-hmm. John Fox. I mean, that's where I met all these people way back in 76, I think. So I just intuitively, this is where I belong. So as things moved along, my first ever testimony in front of the Seattle City Council was in September of 76. I have it in my scrapbook. I was nervous as all get out because I'd never done it. But the SCOR people said, we have to have people to testify. I said, okay, I'll go. So I went down and I testified. And I think it was September of 76. And the next day I was sitting in my office at UBC, which was, right, where are we? Over there. The building was. And my phone rang. I picked it up. This is Gary Clark with the Office of Policy Planning. We're sitting here talking about your testimony. I said, what? And Daryl and Carla Okigwe, who was on staff then, who would also be a good person to talk to if you haven't. I said, oh, and I had no idea. Well, I had quoted something from the Bible, which I, as a minister, as an activist, I was really careful over time not to lay religion on people. Mm-hmm. But there are times when it's just kind of appropriate. So, and this was about creating, the hearing was about creating a lenders review board. And our advocacy was, the banks are redlining. They're not making loans in the African-American neighborhoods, and blah, blah, blah. And there needs to be some regulation, some oversight. And So there was, I guess, an ordinance to create a lenders review board and hold them accountable, something like that. So in the middle of my testimony, I said, "Well, you know, I'm a minister, and the Bible somewhere says about the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath exists to serve the people. The people do not exist to serve the Sabbath." And like unto it, the banks exist to serve the people. The people do not exist to serve the banks. And that was kind of my entree into activism, just that one quote. And Daryl Grothaus, every once in a while, I still quote that back to me almost 50 years later. So it went from there. And we created the Summer 77. A bunch of us, I started meeting people as a result of the SCORE thing. Summer 77, John Fox and I organized the Seattle Displacement Coalition. At the same time, I organized the Church Council's Task Force on Redlining. And there was also a national redlining, Community Reinvestment Act was passed nationally. So there was some resolution on the issue. I don't know if it's completely solved. I doubt. But so other things were moving along. And what we were seeing was an increase in two things. Following the local Boeing depression of the early mid-70s, all of a sudden the economy was turning around and things were taking off in the late 70s. And what was happening? Rents were going up. Condo conversions, demolitions of existing affordable rental housing, privately owned, not publicly subsidized stuff. And so we organized the Displacement Coalition, and then also I organized what became known as the Urban Task Force of the Church Council. The Church Council was very fluid, very flexible, provided a launching place, an incubator for all kinds of activities. And some of them were programs that actually had staff, and some of them were just bringing people together ecumenically and from the larger community to work on particular issues. In this case, it was affordable housing and rental issues. And so we got the Urban Task Force off the ground. In fact, that effort in the fall of 77 was when Charlie Royer was running for mayor. And our base where we started a lot of this stuff was Pilgrim Congregation, where Craig was pastor. We held, I think, one of the first debates in the mayoral race between Charlie Royer and Paul Schell, either in the summer or the fall of 77, and at Pilgrim Congregational. So that's how involved we started to get. And I got so involved in all that kind of stuff, I finally just left the staff of the church, or of University Baptist. And Bill Cade at the Church Council, you know, he knew what we were doing. We'd created this task force, and he said, I went to see him one day, and he said, you know, why don't you come over here to the council and staff the task force? I was chairing it. And then his famous words, which he issued to all kinds of people, we'll find some money.
Right.
I spent the next 20 years of my life trying to raise money for myself and somehow survived. But believe me, I was never rolling in it. But it was worth it. So, I mean, that's the beginning. That's what got me going. And then everything just...
So tell me about your involvement with getting DESC off the ground.
Yeah. Well, I joined the Church Council staff in 78. started making some noise and began to connect with activists in the city, probably more people in the secular community. See, my work as a minister with an ecumenical organization was just across a broad range of issues and characters and organizations, not limited by any means. In fact, I probably worked more with secular groups than religious groups. But as a person representing the ecumenical community. And so I, over time, just became acquainted with more and more folks. And at that point, the 178, and I've got something in the document there, the issue of condo conversions became serious. And developers, et cetera, were buying up buildings, converting them, et cetera, and evicting people. So we had, in fact, that's the first one there. I don't know, we organized some kind of spontaneous group, and we started advocating for a moratorium on conversions in 78. And went down to city council, met with council members, et cetera, and convinced them to pass a 6-month moratorium on condo conversions, during which the city council managed, I think, to pass a resolution regulating those. I don't remember the details. I do know that that did happen and probably mitigated the harm, you know.
Maybe slowed it down.
Yeah, right. And I would say, you know, in the course of my activism, if there was any success, it was to ameliorate the pain, to mitigate problems. I mean, you and I both know that the problem of homelessness, lack of affordable housing, et cetera, now is worse than it's ever been, at least in our memory.
And definitely,
it,
yes.
And so... We had some successful efforts to, you know, to hold these forces somewhat at bay, but because of the priorities of our economy, our politics, et cetera, you know, we're losing. We're just losing. So,
Right. I was telling you that before this, this morning I was reading a couple of your articles in Real Change back in 1999, where you were talking about the just explosion of homelessness, and just thinking, and that's about when I first started living and working in Seattle, and more in 1995. But now the report just came out. Homeless count highest it ever. It keeps exploding,
and it's not going to change. It's not going to change. I'm not going to be very helpful here, I don't think, because I do not have a sanguine view. You mentioned in your book near the end the Committee on Homelessness and All Home or whatever, these cycles. Mm-hmm. And previous to that, Royer and others had special task forces. I mean, it was just kind of like repeating cycles, on and on and on. And, well, one of the good things that it's our advocacy and it's amelioration. It was a housing levy.
Mm-hmm. That was big.
The city didn't initiate that. Mm-hmm. We did, but nobody really knows that. I'm sure that Charlie takes credit for it, and he should because he was the mayor. But the successor to the Urban Task Force, and this was in the mid '80s. And I was staffing that task force. By then, I became basically the church council's urban guy. And so I was involved in a lot of stuff. Article came out in one of the newspapers, probably both, when we had both.
Right.
And, the city is going to put a levy on the ballot to house elephants in the zoo.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh. Don't we need housing for people? So we successfully embarrassed the city. I think we sent out a press release. I think we. I tried to find it, and I couldn't. There's some stuff that I have somewhere in my archives about this. But we got some press coverage about, I don't know if it was just us or us and allies, but anything. This group over here is saying, oh, if we're gonna pass a levy to house elephants, how about if we get a levy to pass, you know, to build housing for people? And a bunch of us, including Tony Lee, is that a familiar name to you?
He's now deceased. Vaguely.
He's now deceased. Sharon and Tony were married, Sharon Lee.
And oh, yes. She talked about that.
Tony was a long time. He died of, I guess it was ALS. He's such a great activist. But they both had the same last name. And they were married for quite a while. And I performed their wedding ceremony way back, I guess, in the 80s at the Arboretum. Anyway, Tony... John, I don't know if Joe was involved. I mean, it was so long ago. It's 40 years ago we went in there. And we met with Carol Lewis, Charlie's longtime deputy, in one of the conference rooms of the mayor's office. And they were cool to the idea, but we kept pushing it. And I don't remember how we succeeded in moving things along, but we did. Of course, we had to go to city council. So eventually what happened was... the same time, I don't know what happened to the elephants. I suppose it went on. It was called the Elephant House. Maybe I suppose it went on. But there were a group of downtown folks that wanted to build a new art museum downtown. And so we managed, and we didn't want to compete. So we managed not a a cooperative campaign. Mm-hmm. Build art and housing, something like that. But they were two separate votes. Mm-hmm. And we succeeded in doing that and getting both on the ballot, and they both passed. And as a result, we have this art museum down on First Avenue, which I think is a mistake. It should have been the Seattle Center, but, you know, it's not. So, you know, it's like that. That's my opinion, obviously. But they both passed. But I think that our levy got more votes than the art museum did. I could be wrong, but that's so. Then we got the levy up and running, and then it's just gone on and on and on. So there's a success right there, right? So every 5-6 years there's a new levy, and it's passed every time. And
yeah,
the
just
current mayor
again.
is just pushing it, you know, way up. So. So we have these small victories. Well, that's not small, but it. You know, I've been thinking about what to talk about, and I mean, I can talk about this stuff. You know as much or more than most folks in this city. I can't illuminate you very much. No city, no county, no state can solve homelessness. Can't be done. We see the numbers go like this. Up. Just see the latest numbers. Up. Headline recently, more homeless than ever in, you know, King County. There are at least two things that need to happen, and I'm not going to live to see either of them. I'm 82 years old. You got to take profit out of housing. As long as there's profit in housing, it's not going to happen. There are too many vested interests in keeping it that way. Mm-hmm. And the other problem, and you mentioned this in a couple of different ways in your book, it's a systemic problem. Over the years, I've done a lot of presentations, workshops, and so on the issue. And I will sometimes say homelessness is the most dramatic manifestation of poverty in America. And every once in a while, people will say, oh, you mean homelessness is related to poverty? I'm serious. Yeah. People are homeless because they're poor. Think about it.
Right.
And of course, that's not the only reason, but there it is. So it's systemic. It has to do with where we invest our resources. This stuff about the Third Avenue story. This is a segue, but I love it in terms of the misdirection of the city. So you're probably aware that recently there's been a lot of hoo and ha about Third Avenue because, you know, the buses are running up and down and there, you know, a lot of drug activity and guys sitting there and, you know, rah, 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 rah. So what do we do? In the 80s, the city came up with the idea of digging a tunnel under downtown, a good part of it under Third Avenue. And then because the buses were running up and down Third Avenue.
That. Yeah.
The buses are currently running up and down. Yes. Well, how'd that happen? I thought we were going to put them underground. So they did. We put in a tunnel, buses went up and down. And then as an afterthought, I guess, they laid tracks. Okay, maybe we'll put in light rail. And so they laid the tracks. Some years later, okay, now we're going to do light rail. Discovered the tracks were the wrong gauge. So they had to rip out the tracks and put in new tracks. And then they got the trains going. And then the trains tried to go up and down. And, of course, the tunnel was under Third Avenue. And Third Avenue was opened up, right? And then finally said, well, we can't keep doing that. So let's put the buses back up on Third Avenue. And now people are saying, we got problems on Third Avenue. I said, weren't we saying that in the 80s? You see, at my age, everything I've done and everything I've seen, how crazy I get? I get crazy. I get completely crazy. And you say, well, where'd this come from? Duh. So, you know, living wage jobs, access to health care, investment in public education. Boy, public education has really taken it in the shorts, you know, for the last couple of decades. You mentioned in the book, and I'm late in life, and I'm really even later in life now. But around the time, shortly before I allegedly retired, I started teaching at Antioch. And I taught there for 14 years as an adjunct from 2004 to 2018. One of the courses I taught, I had four topics that I, you know, one was on homelessness. And one of the things I tried to get clear with the kids, I call everybody younger than I, a kid, you're a kid.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I said, before 1980, now I'm talking about since World War II, because your book has illuminated me about the early stuff, you know, like shack towns and so on. That's really interesting. Before 1980, homelessness as a major social problem in the United States did not exist. It doesn't mean there weren't skid roads and winos or, you know, whatever.
Chronic inebriates.
It was all there. And a lot of it was right down on First Avenue and so on. I mean, you trace that. But it was isolated. Why did we open DESC? Because we saw in the late 70s, and this was, again, people who were in, well, like Joe Martin, David Newcomer of the Downtown Human Services Council and other folks, there's an increase in the number of chronic inebriates and people with mental illness. Mm-hmm. And the missions can't handle them. So that was part of the impetus to create DESC. And I went to what was then called the Seattle, the King County Mental Health Board, I think. So this is 79. And because we negotiated with SHA to get access to the mezzanine and the Morrison. But we, two of the people on our committee were Eleanor Owen, who I don't know if she's still alive or not. She was old then, but with the Whammy Washington Advocates for Mental Health, and Nancy Fernandez, I think. And so they were mental health advocates. And Joe Martin from the Pike Market Clinic and several others. So it was this awareness that the missions, there was increasing number of the people on the streets, not only was the numbers, but the missions simply didn't have the capacity. So we got a grant from the King County Mental Health Board to have a part of the, and they've carried it on to this day. I guess it was a space or something for folks who were exhibiting mental health problems. And we got money for that and got some staff for that. And so that has continued to grow. That was a long aside. Now I forgot where I was. But it...
What was happening in the eight, like starting in 1980?
Yeah, like you were talking. Yeah, right. So that's, and I tell my kids, or did tell when I was teaching, and I taught that course several times. 1980, and they got it. If you start reading about kind of the history of social problems, poverty problem, not just homelessness, you know, and if you read broadly at all, you begin to see that year. 1980 comes around a lot, plus or minus. So, I mean, we opened DESC in 79. We founded Common Ground in 1980. And some years after that, when I finally started using a computer, spell check did not recognize the word homelessness.
Really?
Well, guess what it wanted to put in its place?
Houselessness? No.
It's really good.
What's that?
Hopelessness.
Ah.
One letter. And it tells the whole story. Now, Speltec now recognizes homelessness. Right. Not, no problem, but... People didn't talk about homelessness as a problem. It doesn't mean that people weren't homeless. I mean, you got it in there. It's been around, but not as a major social problem. You know, we're saying, and no city, I've said this before, no city is going to solve homelessness on its own. I mean, the cuts in the federal housing programs in 1980, you know.
When Reagan came in.
Yeah, just went down. And the homeowner tax deductions, you know, up, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just we have a public housing program in the United States, and it's for people. And you accept it, of course. It's for people who own homes. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't think this is helpful to you because I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Well, but it's not just me. It's, you know, it's listeners and people in the future.
Yeah, or anybody. I'm so frustrated and there was so much effort. And it was like pushing up, rock up the hill in this city against City Hall and the downtown establishment. City Hall and the downtown establishment. And often with not much appreciation, especially not from the downtown establishment. You know, I ran for city council in 2009.
I do remember that, yes.
Against Sally Bagshaw. She was, you know, the downtown community's fave, obviously. But I loved what the Seattle Times. In fact, I did a sermon on the topic. So the Seattle Times and its endorsement article, you know,
of you,
no,
or Sally.
Oh, Sally.
Yes, Seattle Times. Sally. Yes.
No way. No. The Seattle Times does not. I think the PI, if it existed, might have endorsed me. I had every Democratic district endorsement. She did not, but it didn't matter. But in their endorsement article, you know, they raved about Sally, and then they made, you know, some kind of, oh yeah, you know, he's been working on stuff on, you know, however, We're concerned that he would view too many issues through the prism of the disadvantaged.
The prism of the disadvantaged.
Yeah, so I made a sermon under that title, Through the Prism of the Disadvantaged.
Interesting.
They put that in print. That was a problem. They couldn't endorse me because obviously that's what he would do. I guess they were right.
Interesting.
Yeah, anyway. I'm just an old, tired, retired activist. You know, I don't have much to offer.
So do you have, I know you get together with a lot of people that you've worked with over the years.
I host them all, too, actually. They're all at my apartment.
Oh, nice.
Bloom's Bar. You should come.
Yeah. Bloom's Bar. And I know that some of them are still active.
Rick retired, and now he's back on the streets.
Yeah. In his work.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So...
And let's see, who else? Well, Paul Benz comes. Paul was the longtime director of Faith Action Network, and now he's doing contract work for the Duwamish, I think, in Olympia. So he's still going down there.
And Bill's still doing the interface.
Bill's just carrying on, you know.
Yeah. And the vehicle residency.
Yeah, he's a hero. I mean, he's just about the only person that really took that on.
The vehicle residency?
Yeah. And it's a huge...
And way before anybody was really acknowledging
nobody was issue. People were, sleeping in cars and whatever, yeah. And you could say it carved out a niche, but it's a pretty big niche.
Mm-hmm.
And it was being ignored. And it's, of course, still being ignored.
And growing.
Yeah, and growing. Yeah. So... I'm not often speechless, but
so I have something that's okay to ask you. I think I mentioned it in my Skid Road book, in terms of like looking at the history of all of this and, you know, since settler colonial times in Seattle and King County. And I'm a preacher's kid, full disclosure. My father was a Presbyterian minister.
I've got two of my higher education degrees are from Presbyterian-related institutions.
And I'm also a divinity school dropout.
Aha.
But very kind of like not – practicing or whatever.
A lot of people aren't practicing. That's a whole other story. We talk about the decline and near disappearance of the American church right now. Yeah.
But one of the things that really surprised me was, and historians talk about this too, of the fact that since the beginning of especially Seattle as a settler colonial city in our area, that it has been one of the most kind of secular cities in the country.
Exactly.
Even with, the early, I know it's a problematic term, but pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, how kind of an outsized influence the churches, especially Protestant denominations, but also Catholic, have had on, and Jewish faith too, have had on the social fabric of Seattle, that I kind of see you as part of that, part of that fabric.
I hope so.
So what do you see in terms of kind of the near past of that and continuing now and into the future of what form it might have?
I don't see it. The church council it still exists. It's in a very different form. They've moved their operation into South Seattle, South County, focusing primarily on refugee issues, which are obviously very important, mm-hmm. but it's a very different sort of organization. The council does not, the prime years of the Church Council were the 70s and 80s when Bill Kate was the director. And we addressed, and I just, not that I was involved, but, you know, as a staff, you know, we addressed this, a broad range, you know, from poverty to civil rights to anti-war to women's rights to LGBTQ rights. In fact, I appeared on a test at a press conference when we were, there was an initiative in the late 80s. It was either anti-gay or pro-gay. I can't remember. It's so long ago. But I remember that I spoke on behalf of the Church Council, and this was a press conference, so it came out in the news. I got back to the office, and remember those little pads that said, while you were out? And mm-hmm, there was a message. Mm-hmm. While you were out, an irate woman called, and her message was, homosexuality is a sin, and you are a nerd.
Oh, you're a nerd.
So that's in my scrapbook. I still have it.
There you go.
I said, that's good. Yeah, I am a nerd.
Yeah, well, that was also the HIV AIDS epidemic kind of sweeping the country, too.
I mean, the denomination, well, okay, my orientation is so-called mainline denominations. Mm-hmm. That's what the ecumenical movement in the United States can trace its origins to the first decade of the 20th century. It's when the Federal Council of Churches was organized. That's when the social gospel movement was in its ascendancy. You have one mention of it in the book, part of the progressive era. Mm-hmm. One of my great heroes is Walter Rauschenbusch, who was probably the leading exponent of the social gospel movement. His book in 1907, Christianity and Social Crisis, was the best-selling religious book in the world after the Bible for several years in 1907 for, you know, those years around there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so there was, and the Federal Council evolved over time into the National Council of Churches. The denominations in America hit their ascendancy, their zenith, I guess, in the 50s, and just powerful institutions. And the Church Council, what was originally called the Greater Seattle Council of Churches, organized in 1919. And if you look back on the history of local, regional, state councils of churches in the United States, a large number, maybe the majority of them, were organized somewhere in that era, in the first two decades of the 20th century. And it was just a very powerful, very strong moment of ecumenical leadership, nationally and locally. And Council of Churches in Seattle played a role in that. hired Bill Kate as the director in 1970 with a very flexible structure, but also programmatic structure to allow it to be an incubator, a birthplace for all kinds of mm-hmm. activism. And if a group of religious folks wanted to come together and focus on racial justice or minimum wages or LGBTQ or Central America, we initiated the call for sanctuary. University Baptist was the first church to respond, by the way. I don't know if you know that. We were a sanctuary congregation for several years. The Archdiocese got involved with that. My friend Charlie McConus worked on the Peace Task Force, and he was former priest. Not follower. The words go. Anyway, had been an ally of the Berrigans on the East Coast in the 60s, and came out here and staffed some significant anti-war, anti-nuke work,
mm-hmm.
Including the lot of civil disobedience at the Trident base. I mean, it was just a very rich activist time. Well, what's happening now? The churches on the whole, denominations are going like that. Mm-hmm. Congregations are going like that. Ministers are leaving the ministry. The rise of the so-called nuns, N-O-N, not N-U. So the life has kind of been sucked out of it. So I don't know the answer to that question.
All right, because there are a lot of social justice movements, but not not really faith based, unless
not as certain. I wouldn't say there aren't any, but it's
right.
And
not
again,
as much.
I'm just as I I said this before. I'm tired. I come to a point where I realize that I can't solve these problems. Mm-hmm. I've done stuff, tried to do stuff, did some stuff, tried to make a difference, probably did a little, but watch what's happening, and I can't speak for the church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even when I was, even at the act, and I was always out there somewhere on the edge anyway. I mean, I was not mainstream. I mean, I tried to appear that way. I buttoned up.
In certain areas, yeah. Right.
I'm a Baptist minister. What's your problem? Never thought of myself as a radical, although I've been accused of being one.
And a nerd.
Yeah. I'm a radical nerd.
Proud nerd.
Yeah. Oh, I got a joke for you. When I was in seminary, no, in D.C., I was there for 4 years. And in our the congregation I served right downtown, we had five ministers on staff. That's how big it was.
Yeah.
And one of the guys was he was the director of our community ministry program, and just did a lot of really good stuff. It was we were right on the edge of a large black community, so we had all kinds of stuff going on. So, and his wife was a stereotypical, a quintessential California blonde, and I think she was from there, and her name was Betsy. And we had some kind of event. We're sitting in a kitchen in church building or something. And in those days, I like a lot of guys my age, I had long hair and I had a goatee. Well, I still have a goatee. And it looked very different than I do now. But, and here's the California bleach blonde over there. And so we're sitting there blobbing. And she made some kind of radical statement. And I said, "Oh, Betsy, you look like a cheerleader, but you're really a radical." She looked right back at me and says, "David, you look like a radical, but you're really a cheerleader." I love that.
And she gave it back to you. That's great. So anything that I haven't asked you that you wanted to wrap up with?
It's like I said, I don't feel like I have anything to offer. I mean, I've got, you've got documents. You apparently read some of my stuff. I'm a retired activist. I worked on a lot of stuff. I've been on a lot of boards. I was the president of the Real Change Board for a while. I was on the PDA Council. You mentioned the PDA, Pike Market PDA, and the mm-hmm. social programs. I was the chair of the committee that in the early 80s. I ran a four-year term there. So I have a history of activism in terms of initiating issues, showing up at city council meetings, being involved with a broad range of groups, having some official roles, kind of a peripatetic activist, I guess. Had a clear vision, I think, of the gospel, which is love one another, take care of one another. That's really all it is.
Mm-hmm.
You can get into the God stuff, and there's a lot of confusion about that, But I do believe that we are all tied together, as Dr. King said, one garment of destiny, something like that. And I do believe that, and I believe there is a spiritual connection that unites all of us, and we should recognize that and affirm it and work for its realization in day-to-day life. And why aren't we doing that? And why do people say, we're not responsible for one another? Poverty is your fault. Well, you got it right here. No, You got enough stuff there that says, no, there are systemic issues here. We don't invest in people. And until we turn that around, we're in big trouble. You know, and the fact that Donald Trump is actually, at least in some people's mind, considered to be a serious candidate to be president of the United States. I said, what the fuck's going on? I learned how to say fuck in seminary, by the way. So all I can do here, Josephine, is to vent.
And I kind of notice a bit of not despair, but lack of hope for where we're going, maybe?
I ain't going to give up on hope.
Okay.
But do I feel despair? Yes. If a person has been involved as long as mm-hmm. I have trying to, and I'll use the word again, ameliorate the problems, I would like to say solve them. But we've had some success. I mean, the housing levy is a good thing. DESC is a good thing.
Healthcare for the homeless.
I didn't play any role in that, but that's
Charlie
a good thing.
Warrior did, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, and the Pike Market Clinic, Joe helped to launch that. You know, yeah, we've made a difference. But the larger issues, you know, you can win battles and lose wars, and we're losing the war. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church has 7 deadly sins. And over my work on just trying to preserve and protect and increase the supply of affordable housing, that was kind of one of our mm-hmm. standard mantras. After all that work and pushing against it, so many forces pushing back against us, I decided that the most destructive sin in the United States, and I won't speak outside of here, and certainly in Seattle, is greed.
Mm-hmm. Kind of late stage capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's just flat out greed. You see, Ivan Boesky died.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of greed.
Yeah.
He went to, I was reading his obituary, he went to, come on, Redford. Oh, darn it. That won't come. He went to a high school in Detroit, which was, I grew up in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And my older brothers went to Redford High School. And he went to a high school that was nearby. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
Right.
His age was between mine and my older brother's. Mm. Detroit, I mean, there's a story, right? What happened to Detroit? Almost 2 million people in 1950 when I lived there. Like maybe 600,000 now. Vast neighborhoods that are just gone. Now they're rebounding apparently. But the problem and the problems are systemic. Homelessness is simply a symptom of the larger systemic problems.
So, and a manifestation of poverty, as you were saying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's the most dramatic manifestation of poverty. And unless we address the systemic problems, no committee to end homelessness in King County or anywhere else.
A regional authority.
Or the regional authority. None of it. And you've seen these things going like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they bring this guy out from Columbus and pay him $250,000 or whatever. And I said, what? I'm tired.
It's a lot of frustration, yeah.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm impressed that you're willing to weigh in on this stuff.
I do, but carefully and only to audiences that at least are open to thinking about issues, because it has become so divisive, like so many other issues in our country.
I know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for taking time today to come talk about your work, and thank you for your decades of dedication to preserving, growing affordable housing. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. If you want any, you know, you probably don't, but I got tons of that stuff.
Well, it's important.
Yeah,
I mean,
I got a lot. I tried to pull out stuff that would give you some notion of our activism, primarily in housing policy. Yeah. I'm proud of, you know, the current director of DESC.
Daniel Malone?
Daniel Malone. The Church Council celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2019. It was founded in 1990, so they had a big event at Plymouth Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I got some recognition, which was nice, and DESC came up, and he met me in the hall afterwards, and he just said, you know, one sentence, and you know, and I said, which was, thank you for founding DESC.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah.
Oh, that's had a huge outsized impact, too.
Do you know why it's called emergency?
Because it was thought of as an emergency that could be solved.
And you got it in the book. That when all this stuff started happening way back there around 1980, late 70s, mm-hmm. early 80s, we thought this was kind of a kind of a temporary
right.
problem.
A little blip.
So it's a little blip, and you know, we'll pull this thing together and we'll get the people off the street and give, you know, folks with mental illness, we'll get a little help, and we can do this thing. And then at a press conference a little later, when Ken Cole was the director, I was there. And he said, it was prescient, and among other things that he said, homelessness in America is a growth industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 40 years ago. And nothing has turned that around.
It still is, yes.
Yeah, it's a growth industry. Because we don't care about poor people. Well, that's an overstatement. We don't care about poor people. And there are a lot of other people we don't care about. Part of the problem, we don't care about each other. That's fundamental.
Right.
You don't care about one another, then you got a problem. It's not just about me.
Okay. Well, thanks again for taking time today.
I'm always glad to talk.
Yeah. Thank you.